Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Senator Elizabeth Warren put it pretty clearly to the now former CEO of Wells Fargo when she said, quote, "You squeezed your employees to the breaking point so they would cheat customers and you could drive up the value of your stock and put hundreds of millions of dollars in your own pocket," close quote. But what that powerful statement still omits is that Wells Fargo didn't cheat any and all customers. Their fraud, opening some 2 million accounts for people without their knowledge, was targeted specifically at black and brown communities. The same communities at the sharp end of Wells Fargo practices in other arenas, like pipelines and private prisons. Activists are using this scandal to call attention to a range of other problems at the bank, problems not addressed by a couple of top executives giving back some of their golden parachutes. Saqib Bhatti is director of the Refund America Project and co-executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy. We'll talk with him about the Forgo Wells campaign. Also on the show, corporate media are very interested in Donald Trump's taxes, as well they should be. But there's plenty to be said about unfairness in the tax system even before we get to the tax dodger in chief. Jeremy Greer is vice president of policy and research at the Corporation for Enterprise Development. They say the tax code doesn't reflect inequality, it actually drives it. We'll talk with him about CFED's Turn It Right Side Up campaign. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. The New York Times is likely the single most influential newspaper in the English language world, not just because of its reach, but because it defines the boundaries of acceptable debate. Being in the New York Times is a legitimizing event. That's what comes to mind when you learn that the paper has just handed a biweekly opinion column to Wall Street Journal deputy editorial page editor Brett Stevens. It's not just that Stevens is yet another white man, like 9 of the other 12 current columnists, though it certainly is that. It's also that stamp of acceptable opinion being given to someone who, as folks like Hamilton Nolan at Fusion and Zed Jelani at The Intercept have documented, holds a number of opinions that could generously be termed fringe. He is a climate change denier, as listeners may have heard, but he's also an anti-Arab, anti-black racist, an advocate of torture, and a believer that the problem of campus rape is an imaginary enemy. As FAIR analyst Adam Johnson notes, Stevens has referred to anti-Semitism as the disease of the Arab mind, insisted Palestinians have a blood fetish, called Black Lives Matter a lie based on the myth of victimization, institutionalized racism is another imaginary enemy, and in a piece subtly headlined, "I am not sorry the CIA waterboarded," he contended that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in fact, waterboarded himself by not being truthful with his captors. As Jelani points out, the Stevens hire is especially weird given the New York Times' current PR campaign as a pursuer of truth in an era of fake news. "The truth is more important now than ever," says a recent ad. And as Johnson notes, hiring Stevens highlights the radical asymmetry at work when considering what is and isn't fringe opinion. If you're going to the neocon right, apparently you can't go too far. But on the other end of the spectrum, anything to the left of Hillary Clinton is unacceptable, a fact that became abundantly clear during the 2016 primary, when all of the paper's liberal or pro-democratic columnists lined up behind Clinton, and Paul Krugman even claimed falsely that every serious progressive policy expert on either health care or financial reform who has weighed in on the primary favored Clinton. Krugman was the closest the page got to support for single-payer health care, supported by minimally a plurality of Americans and a majority of Democrats, and his position was that it's just not going to happen. What Brett Stevens' hire tells us, then, is that on the opinion page of the country's paper of record, things like universal health care or free college are pie-in-the-sky fantasies no serious person takes seriously, while climate denial and racism are the paper, So its editors say, bringing a new perspective to bear that further widens their vibrant diversity of opinions. Well, Bill O'Reilly's attorney issued a statement earlier this week saying that the Fox host was the victim of a brutal campaign of character assassination unprecedented in post-McCarthyist America, which he has irrefutable evidence is being orchestrated by far-left organizations for their own gain. It's not clear if that evidence will be forthcoming now that O'Reilly is out of his spot at the top of Fox's roster. It was, of course, the far-left New York Times that ran the story that appears to have started the snowball rolling, reporting earlier this month that Fox had paid some $13 million to settle at least five lawsuits from women who charged the host with things like verbal abuse, sexual comments, unwanted advances, and phone calls better left undescribed. Corporate advertisers, undeterred by O'Reilly's years of on-air racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, outright lying, and hate-mongering, evidently decided that that was a bridge too far. Okay. It's hard not to celebrate the end of the sheer toxicity O'Reilly's show put out, but activist groups like Ultraviolet, who worked for his ouster, underscore that the problem is bigger than him. Fox News executives gave cover for harassment and abuse for years. There's no reason to believe that culture has changed, particularly as the network won't make the results of their investigation public. The group Media Matters, who would assuredly have been cited by O'Reilly's lawyer, reminded that calling for boycotts of institutions he doesn't like were part of O'Reilly's stock in trade. His website still maintains a list of media outlets that traffic in defamation, and urges readers not to patronize or advertise with them. On that list is pretty much any outlet that makes any reference to his harassment history. The Dayton Daily News had the temerity to mention it, leading to a threatening call from O'Reilly's producer demanding they run an apology. When they didn't, O'Reilly told his audience that the paper had sympathy for child rapists. A Roanoke Times editor named Daniel Rodmacher mentioned harassment charges and poked fun at O'Reilly's War on Christmas thing, for which he and his paper were targeted on the host's TV and radio shows, with O'Reilly complaining to millions about, quote, extremely mean-spirited personal attacks on me by a guy named Dan Rodmacher, a left-wing loon. We did some research on him, and it's disgraceful. And they go on our don't buy, don't advertise list, Roanoke Times, because anybody who would employ a guy like that, and you know, and we did, we walked back and looked at what he did, is irresponsible. It's just horrible. Close quote. Who does that sound like? At Fair, we have mixed feelings about advertiser boycotts, which draw on the power corporate sponsors have to control content. But for that to be the thing that freed the airwaves of Bill O'Reilly, well, that's just karma. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Recently, executives of Wells Fargo were forced to give back some of the money they'd personally made from coercing employees to open and charge fees on some 2 million accounts for people without their knowledge, with, it should not be forgotten, a target on low-income and African-American communities. Millions of Americans are still struggling with the impact of these predatory measures and their like, and let's not forget either the more than 5,000 low-level employees Wells Fargo fired, as though they'd come up with the hyper-aggressive cross-selling goals themselves. The fact that this is the same Wells Fargo that is among the primary financial backers of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the same Wells Fargo that bankrolls the expansive private prison industry, has led activists to address the company as not the only blameworthy financial industry actor, but a real crystallization of how banks finance racism. Saqib Bhatti is director of the Refund America Project and co-executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy. He works on a campaign called Forgo Wells. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Saqib Bhatti.
Great to be here.
Well, I'd like to start with the fraudulent accounts, though I know that that's just one head of the Hydra. Media accounts are presenting the decision to take back some millions in compensation from Wells Fargo former CEO John Stumpf and Carrie Tolstead, who ran the community banking department at the center of the fraud. That clawback is being described as epic, the biggest in industry history, and so on. But I saw a piece by Peter Dreyer that suggested that media reports are leaving out some important bottom-up organizing work that played a role in getting to this development, but that is aimed actually at much more. Can you talk a little bit about the activism behind, whatever we may say, a still rare example of any price being paid by higher-ups for this really devastating behavior?
Yes, I mean, on that point, that's actually very interesting that it doesn't actually take all that much to be the highest fine ever paid by Wall Street, because actually it just doesn't happen. The point that was really at the heart of Peter Dreyer's article was a very important one, which is that the scandal around the fraudulent accounts was actually whistleblowers within the bank who were bank workers organizing with the Committee for Better Banks, who raises concern that as a matter of their employment, in order to keep their jobs, they're being forced to meet these aggressive sales goals. And in so doing, they're really being forced into opening fraudulent accounts. There is a petition that the Committee for Better Banks launched 3 years ago before the scandal broke that got over 10,000 signatures. And so that's one of the key things that's actually very important, because the company cannot deny that they knew that this was happening. Because, in fact, 10,000 of their own workers signed a petition and gave it to them 3 years earlier saying, look, we're being forced to do this. We know this is illegal. We know this is wrong. It's unethical. We feel very bad about it. And the company continued to do those practices.
Yeah, and I think it's really exciting to hear about employees and consumers, you know, being in coalition around these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that this is one of the things that's not as well understood in the United States, but in other parts of the world, bank workers are generally unionized. In places where bank workers are unionized, part of the role that the union is able to serve is to actually empower them to be whistleblowers, because it gives them workplace protections so they can raise these issues and fight on behalf of consumers.
Well, Wells Fargo, as listeners will know, is one of some 17 banks financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. They're also deep in private prisons, which I heard an activist point out are targeted not because they're worse than public prisons, though they may be, but because they're expansionist and they rely on banks to do that. There's a theme here. You see a coherence in terms of the communities harmed by Wells Fargo, yeah?
Absolutely. It is no mere accident that time and again we find that when there are issues that are harming communities of color, if you look at where the money is coming from, it's almost always coming from Wall Street, and right at the head of the pack, you always have Wells Fargo. Racism isn't just a side effect of what Wells Fargo does. It's part and parcel of what it does, whether it's, as you mentioned, fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline or funding these immigrant detention centers and getting ready to profit off of Trump's heightened enforcement on immigration issues, or just going back to the fact that they were actually one of the leading banks when it came to mortgage discrimination, really targeting communities of color with predatory mortgages. In fact, workers from within the bank have come forth and said that within Wells Fargo, they referred to subprime mortgages as ghetto loans and said that they were intended for mud people. This is a type of culture that you had within Wells Fargo. They also help finance the payday lending industry, which preys on communities of color. And even with the scandal around fraudulent accounts, one of the lesser reported stories, the workers also came forward and said that they were actually targeting Spanish speakers in particular, right? So what we found is time and again, it's Black and Latino communities that are targeted for the worst of Wells Fargo's racist practices.
It seems so important to say it's not that it's an indifferent structural capitalism problem that just happens to hurt Black and brown people. It's really targeted that way.
Exactly.
Well, when I look at media, I see
a frame that bugs me, first of all, about how Wells Fargo was engulfed in scandal, you know, like it was a dust storm, and how executives took too long to recognize problems when the fact is that they created the problems and called them policy.
Mm-hmm.
But the upshot is Wells Fargo is going back on the offensive, I learned, after months of apologizing, and that other banks are claiming that they would never, you know, nothing that really looks like change. And what I'd like to see more of is stories about, for example, Portland. You know, I read a piece in Truthout by Mike Ludwig where folks, some of whom were coming back from Standing Rock, are using people power. Can you tell us about how communities are using this point of intervention that we do have around local government investments and contracts?
Yes, around the country, people are saying that we've had enough of Wells Fargo really doing everything it can to extract as much value out of our communities as possible, and we're fighting back. And so the Fargo Wells campaign is really about getting cities, states, counties, school districts across the country to stop doing business with Wells Fargo. So we've had some great victories in cities like Seattle and Oakland. There's resolutions that have already passed saying that the cities will no longer do business with Wells Fargo and to start exploring alternatives. Separately from the resolutions, we've also had executive action in a number of places like Chicago, Illinois, Ohio, where in some cases treasurers, in other cases governors, mayors have themselves decided they're doing what they can to unilaterally move their money out of Wells Fargo as a result of this fraudulent account scandal. And so increasingly, what we're seeing is a movement from the bottom up that's really putting pressure on local elected officials to stand up to Wells Fargo and say that actually all banks are not the same. It's also true that many banks are problematic. Wells Fargo is not alone in financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. But Wells Fargo is the worst. And so there is a grassroots movement to really hold Wells Fargo accountable.
Well, finally, I have heard the line that critics of divestment say essentially banks like Wells Fargo are so big that, you know, they're involved in everything and some of it's bad, you know, as if it were unavoidable. It sounds very close to we can't do everything, so let's do nothing. But what you're saying is we can do and are doing things, lots of things. What's happening April 25th?
So April 25th is the day of the Wells Fargo shareholder meeting. This will be the first shareholder meeting since the fraudulent account scandal broke, since the resignation of the CEO. And so what we're doing is we're calling for a national day of action. We have a petition that we're circulating that you can access from fargowells.org that, you know, calls on the bank to divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline, stop investing and profiting from private prisons, immigrant detention centers, to stop funding the payday lending industry, to stop its tremendous lobbying that it's doing to try to influence our politics, to stop its predatory foreclosure practices, and a number of other demands that we raise. The petition also stands in support of the shareholder resolution that Wells Fargo's own shareholders are putting forth to try to change the bank's behavior, which again sort of calls for it to fix its gender pay gap. It calls on the bank to adopt an indigenous rights policy. And we're also finally calling for the resignation of the bank's directors. The board of directors who are supposed to oversee the bank, they were the CEO's boss, and they were all asleep at the switch. They completely looked the other way while the bank made disastrous policy decisions that were blatantly illegal and blatantly racist. And we're saying that it's time for those directors to go as well. So we have this petition. We have a sign-on letter. We're having a day of action where people will deliver those petitions to Wells Fargo branches across the country and demand that Wells Fargo change at the fundamental level, that they adopt these policies and to demand that they pass the shareholder resolutions and fire the board of directors.
We've been speaking with Saqib Bhatti of Refund America and the Action Center on Race and the Economy. You can learn more about the Wells Fargo campaign online at fargowells.org. Saqib Bhatti, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
The group ProPublica has exposed how efforts to make paying your taxes easy and free with a pre-filled filing from the government, as is done in parts of Europe, have been repeatedly derailed by vigorous lobbying from H&R Block and the makers of TurboTax. It's a kind of icing on the cake of a tax system that many suspect is unfair and slanted against the little guy. But while we complain about tax policy as bureaucratic or baroque, the impact of that policy goes well beyond irritation. Given its crucial place in U.S. society, the tax system should be transparent. But when those who are able to really look at the system and its societal impact, what do they find? Jeremy Greer is Vice President of Policy and Research at the Corporation for Enterprise Development and part of CFED's Turn It Right Side Up campaign. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Jeremy Greer.
Thanks for having me, Jeanine.
Well, before we talk about taxes per se, could you speak a little about the difference between income and wealth and how that picture breaks down racially in this country?
So we think about income, and when we think about the interplay between income and wealth, there's a saying that we use here at CFED quite often is income helps you get by, but wealth helps you get ahead. Mm-hmm. Wealth is the thing that really provides security for your family. It allows your family to think forward to the future, think about things like thinking about your child's education, their higher education, thinking about retirement, what are you going to do when you stop working? Mm-hmm. So while income is important, that provides the resources for you to do that, wealth is something that really provides you that security to think long term. How that breaks down across the country as it relates to racial groups, you know, we did a study recently with the Institute for Policy Studies called The Ever-Growing Gap. And what we found is there is an incredible and really pervasive racial wealth divide, and much more divided than when you look at it by income. If we were to do nothing to change our policies or stop the trajectory, it would take African-American families 228 years to reach parity in wealth with white families, and would take almost 80 years for Latino families to reach parity with white families. So we have a huge wealth divide that is even larger for households of color than there even is when you look at income.
Well, I think some might think that the tax code favors the wealthy, but you say it's more than that, that the tax code drives inequality. How is that?
It does. The tax code is really one of the mechanisms in which wealth is distributed across various income groups and across various ends that the country likes to see. Just in 2015, the federal government spent on wealth-generating activities through tax expenditures, through expenditures through the tax code, about $660 billion. To give you a sense of the scale of that, that is more than the combined budgets of 14 cabinet-level agencies. Well, when you break that down and say, well, who's getting that wealth? What you find is that the top 1% of taxpayers, from an income standpoint, receive more than the bottom 80% of taxpayers combined. And we think that that's upside down. That is not how we think about how we make our investments. So where are these investments being made? They're being made in things like home ownership. You know, when you think about housing subsidies in this country, we tend to think about, you know, programs at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, public housing, Section 8, things like that. But actually, the largest housing subsidies come through the tax code. A little over $200 billion a year in housing subsidies are provided through the tax code to families, and most of them on the very high end. Things like the mortgage interest deduction, which accounts for about $100 billion in spending every year. State and local tax deductions, which account for a good share of the spending every year. So when you think about what's driving inequality, you know, I would say a federal system that is subsidizing the income and expenses and wealth at the high end at the expense of not investing at the low end is really exacerbating that divide.
What's behind it? What's driving that policy?
I would say the major thing that's driving it is special interests. When you look at our tax code system and you look where those benefits are being driven, it's in the places where there is a lot of lobbying dollars behind it. There's two major ways that people earn income in this country. You earn it by wages. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to your job, you get paid by an employer, and that's the exchange. Another way that people earn income in this country is through investment. You take your money, you put it in certain types of interest-bearing accounts, and you get a return on that investment, and that income comes back to your family. Well, the tax code taxes that in different ways. They tax your income at the high end at about 40%, and they tax that investment at the high end at about 20%. So basically what we're saying is that we will take a special and prioritize tax benefits to people that get investment income. And essentially, that is at cost to the government. So why is that? Well, people that get investment income happen to be on the high end. Only about 1% of the country makes investments in the stock market other than through their retirement. And those are the people that are in Congress lobbying to make it that way.
Right.
So when you think about the priority of prioritizing investment income over wages, a lot of that has to do with who's lobbying the Congress to make it that way.
Right. And low-income taxpayers don't have, first of all, that access and that power, but also we have this president who says, I don't pay any taxes and that makes me smart. Obviously, yeah. If you can afford lawyers and accountants, you know, that plays into it too.
Yeah, that's right. And from our standpoint, the way to change that dynamic is, you know, families aren't going to be able to outspend the special interests. I mean, nor should they. I mean, they're worried about putting food on the table, putting clothes on their kids' backs, you know, sending their kids to college. Those are the things that they're thinking about investing their money in. But what they can do is they can have a voice in the conversation. And the way to have a voice in the conversation is they have to be informed. They have to understand why it is the tax system is the way it is and begin to understand it. And there's a role for us in Washington, and that's really what the Turn It Right Side Up campaign is about. It's really educating everyday folks about why the tax code is important, what role it plays in your life. You know, if you feel like you spend too much money for your housing, there's a role that the tax system plays in creating that dynamic. You feel like, you know, you don't have the ability to pay for your kids' college and get them to college. There's a way that the tax code can have an impact on that. And really, our hope is that if we can educate everyday folks around why this is important and how they can engage, we can start to begin that conversation so that the people that we send to Congress hear from more than just a special interest.
Well, Jeremy, how can folks learn more about the Turn It Right Side Up campaign?
It's very simple. If you go to www.turnitrightsideup.org, they can get more information and join the campaign.
All right, then, turnitrightsideup.org. We've been speaking with Jeremy Greer of CFED. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It was great to talk to you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.